Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, ending violence and building peaceful societies, preeminent psychology scholar Irvin Staub says how. Then we explore a unifying theory for science and humanity. Our next guest has long studied the roots of violence, genocide, and other destructive acts. His work then turned to the roots of what he called goodness, when people rescue one another, even at the risk of their own lives. And with that, he has turned to how we can establish societies that are built on altruism and moral courage. Irvin Staub joins us now. His latest book is called The Roots of Goodness and Resistance to Evil, Inclusive Caring, Moral Courage, Altruism Born of Suffering, Active Bystandership, and Heroism. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Irvin Staub. It's great to have you back with us.
It's very nice to speak to you again.
Well, before we get into this latest book that you have just published, The Roots of Goodness and Resistance to Evil, you wrote in the introduction about how your own experiences as a Holocaust survivor shaped your work. Can you first tell us what happened to you and how this has impacted your work?
Well, when I was 6 years old, it was the worst of times in Hungary, certainly for Hungarian Jews. The Hungarian government enacted anti-Semitic laws for quite a long time. It started even before Hitler appeared on the scene in Germany. So over the years, there was quite a bit of anti-Semitism, and Hungary was a voluntary ally of Germany, rather than many other countries which were occupied. And 1944, early, when the Germans found out that the Hungarian ruler was trying to establish a separate peace with the Allies, because he realized that the war was being lost, they occupied Hungary in March 1944. And then 50 SS officers, led by Eichmann, the infamous Eichmann, came to Hungary, and with the help of something like 200,000 Hungarian policemen and gendarmes and people from the population, they gathered all the Jews from the countryside, put them on trains, these incredibly crowded, terrible trains, and took them to Auschwitz. And most of them were killed right away. The Jews in Budapest were left. They were the last ones. But the war was coming to an end. Nonetheless, the Germans and the Hungarian helpers were trying to get rid of all the Jews. So we were first in a house that was designated as a house with Jews in it, and it had to have a yellow star on it. And then we had to wear yellow stars, and then there was a ghetto established, and a lot of Jews had to be moved in there. Now, in the summer, after all Hungarian Jews were killed, there was a refugee board established around that time in the United States. It should have been established much earlier, but it wasn't established, and then finally it was, and one of its first acts was to ask a Swede to go to Hungary and try to save Hungarian Jews. And it was a Swede, because Sweden was a neutral country. And so a Swedish diplomat was asked first, Count Bernadette, but the Hungarians would not accept him. And Raoul Wallenberg, who was not a diplomat, was asked to go because he was a partner in an export-import business with a Hungarian Jew. He lived in Sweden. And so he agreed to go to Hungary, and he acted with great determination, very cleverly, and very heroically in many ways to save lives. And he succeeded to persuade the Hungarian government to allow him to create 4,000 these protective passes that said that the people who hold these passes after the war will go to Sweden, and so they are now under the protection of Sweden. And in addition to these 4,000 passes, he created many more. And so my mother, my aunt, 3 cousins, my sister and I were able to get these protective passes and left our apartment, pushed a little cart during the night with a few belongings, to go to the so-called protected house that Wallenberg set up, not just one, but a number of them. And my father, who was in a forced labor camp, when his group was being taken to Germany, they had a stayover in Budapest in some old military barracks, and he escaped. And for various reasons, he knew where we were. And he came to that house, and the superintendent allowed him in. And he was in hiding in that house. He survived several raids on the house by Hungarian Nazis who were helping the Germans. And so all of us survived in that house. Now, in terms of what influenced my work, another important person was a woman who worked for my family. And rather than leaving us, she came with us to this protected house. This was a Christian woman. And she did all kinds of amazing things to try to help us. One of them was to make dough and take it to a bakery and have it baked into bread and then bring it back. And she did this a number of times. Once she was stopped, she was told that because she is helping Jews, she's a traitor, and they made her stand with her hands up and standing against the wall. And she thought that she will be killed. And then finally, somebody from the neighborhood who was also a Nazi and who knew her came by and said, oh, she's all right, let her go. And she immediately continued to do what she did. And actually, it's possible that my father had the courage to escape because she took to the forced labor camp a copy of this so-called protective pass and had someone call him to the fence and handed him a copy of this. We don't know this for sure, but this may have given him courage. So anyway, we survived in this so-called protected house, and I think that that inspired really everything that I did. You know, I escaped from Hungary in 1956 and lived in Vienna and came to the United States and studied and got a PhD at Stanford in psychology. And then at my first job at Harvard, I started to study what leads people to help others and what leads people not to help when they see other people's need. And then later on, I started to study origins of genocide and mass killing and prevention and reconciliation. And I worked at various places like Rwanda, where I had a number of projects for many years on reconciliation between groups that have harmed each other and so on. But I think these early experiences clearly shaped my work life.
A lot of the studies that you cite, including some of your own, looked at actually different behaviors of children responding to, say, cries of distress, but also adults. I wonder if you could walk us through what some of these studies tell us about people who respond to others who are distressed or in trouble versus those who do not.
Well, the first studies in this area, which were done by two psychologists, Latney and Darley, focused on the situation and found that the larger the number of people who are present, the more likely that any one person, or the less likely that any one person will help. And I was inspired by these studies, and I studied both the circumstances that influence people's behavior, but also the personal characteristics that make it more or less likely that they will help others. And you were asking about the personal characteristics especially. And I found in a series of studies, mostly these studies of personal characteristics with adults, that the more people had a feeling of responsibility for other people's welfare, the more likely they were going to help somebody in distress. And this was true when that person was in physical distress. They would hear sounds of distress from another room. they could go into the other room, or if they didn't go into the other room, that the person from that room came in and asked for their help. And the more they had this, what I actually called, it's a big word, but pro-social value orientation, which has several elements. One of them is a positive view of human beings, concern about others' welfare, and I think the central part of it is a feeling of responsibility for others' welfare. The more they had this, the more likely they were going to help by going into the other room, or if the person came into their room, by doing something more effortful that would provide more immediate help. And the same was true also of helping somebody in psychological distress. You know, somebody, as people work together in the same room on some task, gets upset about something that she reads and then tells this other person something that upset her, that happened to her just the day before. And the more people have this orientation, concern about others, feeling of responsibility, the more likely that they engage in a helpful way. Now, so this is an important personal orientation, and I think that, you know, it includes empathy, feeling others' distress to some degree, but it has an additional element which I think is crucial beyond empathy in order for a person to take action, and that is that feeling of responsibility. And some studies we found that when that feeling of responsibility is combined with the belief that I am capable to influence others' welfare, you know, some sense of competence, belief that one can actually make a difference, then people are even more likely to help.
If an environment makes it such that people do not think they can make a difference, in particular, say, political environments where things seem overwhelming, for example, or if a society is highly individualistic, like personal responsibility rather than thinking of other responsibility, it seems like those would counteract wanting to help.
You know, that's an important point, that the immediate circumstances that people are in have an effect, but the larger social situation also has an effect. So if the larger social situation is such that it makes people feel helpless, or it makes people focus very intensely on themselves, it creates divisions between people rather than connections. You know, all of these things are going to affect people, and they are going to, in some way, modulate, change their orientation towards others, including their feeling of responsibility. So the social world as such is very important and makes a difference. You know, the last chapter in this book is creating caring societies. And in order to create caring societies, there have to be action by people on the top, ideally, action by people on the bottom, the population, all of us, and also action by people in the middle. By people in the middle, I mean people like the media that can influence both downwards and upwards, church leaders that have a potential influence downwards and upwards. All of these are, and if there is a society in which people don't care, nobody takes positive actions, if there is a tendency to cooperate to compete primarily rather than to cooperate with each other, when people don't join together to try to exert influence, then a person may feel helpless.
There are two things you said in this that I wanted to see if you could elaborate a little bit further. One was when you said if people focus too much on themselves, and of course we're talking also about an individualistic sort of culture, but there was also an example in your book of people who were in Nazi-controlled areas, and you interviewed these people at length including some who had been involved in the so-called euthanasia program. It seemed, the way you described it, that they were so involved in their own lives, they didn't even notice what was going on around them.
Yes. I mean, one of the things that I write about in the book is how a group of Germans that I interviewed in quite a while ago now, in 1987, I was invited by a German university to give a talk on the research that they knew I was doing, I have been doing, on altruism and housing behavior. But I asked them, could I instead talk about the origins of genocide? And I asked them if they could arrange for me a meeting with a group of Germans who were at least teenagers in the Hitler era. And they did, and I met with about 25 people like that, and we had a very good conversation, partly because I spoke enough German to communicate with them, since I lived in Vienna for a couple of years before I came to the U.S., but because my German was not that good, it kind of equaled our relationship, balanced our relationship. So rather than being the professor, which is a big thing in Germany, you know, we were kind of equal people talking to each other. And during this conversation, it was difficult for them to get away from the satisfactions of their life under Hitler when they were in youth camps and singing songs together and sitting at campfires together, and they were so involved with their own lives that they didn't look around in the world around them. Now, of course, they were also young people, and that is somewhat characteristic of young people, but not all of them were that young. And it took us a long time for them to finally say, oh, yes, I remember. And one of them said that the local Gestapo came to my father, who was renting out rooms to people, and told my father not to rent rooms to Jews. But they started out saying, oh, we didn't notice. I didn't remember. You know, I didn't know what was going on. But it was so evident in Germany that it was pretty much impossible not to know what was going on. But I think that it wasn't that they were in denial. It was that they were so focused on their lives that they just didn't pay attention to the larger world.
So then people can develop a sort of tunnel vision depending on what's going on in life.
People can develop a tunnel vision so that they don't even notice. And unfortunately, they can also, depending on who they are, they can also easily shift their attention away so that they don't take in what is happening. You may remember a study that I described that we did on the streets of Cambridge, Massachusetts, while I was still teaching at Harvard. And I had a young Harvard student collapse on the street when some passerby was moving towards us and was about 50 yards away. And he collapsed, grabbing his knee or grabbing his heart or for some reason or another. And some people, as they were approaching on the other side of the street in this case, took a single glance and rushed over. Other people looked over, and then they were hesitating, and they were slowing down, and they were looking back, and often somebody else came by that time. But there were some people who, after a single glance, looked away, and they never looked back. And some of these people turned off the street at the next corner. And I think that people do this. They try to avoid taking in information that would make them feel that they need to take action, that they would make them feel responsible. Now, I don't think that these are the people who have this personal disposition to feel responsibility for others' welfare. But there are people who do this. And also, circumstances influence people to do this. One of the things that I talk about is how our values, even if it is high in our hierarchy of values, our caring values, our moral values, can be subverted when the environment very strongly calls on other values. So let's assume that you are a member of the president's advisory group, and there develops a strong tone about attacking another country. And there is a strong influence within the group for that. And when somebody raises any question about anything, then that person's loyalty is questioned. So under these circumstances, values, moral values, caring values, can be replaced by values of loyalty and values of responsibility to my leader and other kinds of things. And as a result, people are not guided anymore by feeling of responsibility for others' welfare. They are guided by their loyalty to the group that they are part of.
So there's a sort of canceling out of what might arise as responsibility or caring for others based on personal need to belong or be loyal or whatever that other thing is. The other part of what you mentioned, you also wrote about in the book, was about empathy. And the studies that you mentioned in your book that I find most compelling and baffling are the studies that show who tends to have empathy for whom. So, for example, very wealthy people, people at the very top, tend to not have empathy for poor people, as an example. And this was some of the things that you wrote about. Whereas poor people do tend to have empathy for all kinds of people. How do we make sense of this?
Well, there isn't really good research on trying to help to understand why this happens. But a likely reason is that people justify their wealth and position in society. People pretty much justify whatever they do, and one of the things that they justify is their wealth and their position. And they justify it by their hard work, by their intelligence, by their special qualities, and for all these reasons, they deserve the position that they are occupying. And in fact, I believe that one of the reasons that people protect their privilege is not only because they love the fruits of that privilege, the money and power, but also because they have developed a belief system according to which they have right to their privilege. Now, if that is the case, then the people who are poor, who haven't accomplished anything, they see them as not having taken responsibility for their lives, as not being diligent enough, not being intelligent enough, not being deserving enough. And I think that explains why they look down on them. And once you look down on people, and once you create a division between us and them, they are different, they are them, they are less good, they are less deserving, you feel less empathy for them. There is research that shows that the more similar we see people to ourselves, the more we feel empathy for them. So this is a real problem, really, because if you want to create a society in which people in general care for each other, a caring society, then we have to see the humanity of everybody. And this kind of looking down on people also means that we see them as less deserving and in some ways less human.
That concludes part one of our conversation with Dr. Irvin Staub, author of The Roots of Goodness. We'll continue our conversation next week. When we come back, we explore the system's view of life with Fritjof Capra. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. Fritjof Capra is a theoretical physicist who has taught at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and Berkeley. He is now on the faculty of Schumacher College and the founder of the Center for Ecoliteracy in Berkeley, California. Capra has authored The Tao of Physics, The Turning Point, The Hidden Connections, and his latest, The Systems View of Life, which seeks to put forward a unifying theory for science and humanity. We began our conversation last week about the basic ideas behind systems theory. We started to discuss what exactly systems theory is, this idea of changing from objects and structures really to these non-material processes. Let's first review this so that we can link it up to all of the developments we're seeing today and where we can be going in the future.
Well, what I have observed over the last 30 years together with many other scientists is that there has been a huge conceptual revolution in science and also in society, which I can summarize in one sentence by saying it is a very fundamental change of metaphors from seeing the world as a machine to understanding it as a network. And everything else really follows from that. A network, of course, is a particular pattern of relationships. And in order to understand networks, we need to learn how to think in terms of patterns and in terms of relationships. And that is what systems thinking or systemic thinking is all about. There's a whole intellectual tradition of systems thinking that started in the 1920s and 1930s with general systems theory and cybernetics, and then reached a new level much later in the 70s and 80s with complexity science. And so in my book, The Systems View of Life, which I co-authored with an Italian biologist, Pierluigi Luisi, we talk about the history and then we talk about the essential characteristics of systems thinking and the new understanding of life that is now emerging.
You mentioned cybernetics and complexity theory. What was cybernetics and how did that help to lead to systems theory?
Cybernetics was a sort of a hybrid enterprise among a group of mathematicians, scientists, and engineers. And it began with machines. It actually began during World War II with ballistics. And there were several very, very ingenious people working in that group, like Norbert Wiener and John von Neumann and Gregory Bateson. And they realized that in complex machines and in nature, we have nonlinear systems. They focused on two particular patterns, the network pattern, especially in neuroscience, and on feedback loops, that is, circular causal connections. They actually invented the term feedback, and that's a lasting legacy of cybernetics.
And complexity theory fits in?
Well, complexity theory came much later when, you see, the cyberneticists and also Ludwig von Bertalanffy with his general systems theory, which was around the same time in the 1930s, both of these groups realized that living systems are nonlinear, but they didn't have a mathematical language to describe nonlinear systems because, as everybody who has any background in mathematics knows very well, nonlinear equations are very complex, and until recently they couldn't be solved, and I'm talking here about differential equations. But in the 1970s and 80s, we had powerful computers at our disposal, and so a group of mathematicians developed a new kind of mathematical formalism to model and study nonlinear systems. And so this complexity theory, or as it's called technically, nonlinear dynamics, is really a mathematics of patterns. And the strange attractors of chaos theory are some of those patterns, the fractals of fractal geometry. And so with this new mathematics, we were able for the first time to model nonlinear systems. And that was a huge conceptual advance.
And you've gone on in your book to talk about these nonlinear living systems, that nonlinearity is a key in living systems. What exactly does that mean to them?
Non-linearity and more specifically networks. Networks, of course, are intrinsically non-linear. And so in the 1980s, there was great interest in these non-linear systems, and several people studied living networks. And that was the first big advance that they found that there is a key characteristic that we can emphasize in living networks to the point where we can say that's really the definition of biological life, and that is that these living networks are self-generating. In a cell, for example, the simplest living system, the cellular network generates all the structures in the cell. The food, the simple molecules come in through the cell membrane, and then the proteins, the lipids, the membranes, the DNA, all these complex structures are built by the cellular network. And they contribute to the cellular network and are formed by the cellular network at the same time. So living systems are self-generating, and that is the key characteristic.
This is what you say distinguishes life from non-living entities.
Right. And it's quite a clear-cut distinction, although there are always, borderline cases. By the way, technically, this is known as the theory of autopoiesis, which means self-making. And it was created by two Chilean biologists, Humberto Maturana and Francisco Varela. And so this autopoiesis now lets us say that, for instance, a computer is not a living system because a computer does not build itself. It can maybe to some extent repair itself if it's programmed in the right way, but it does not build its components. The same with a virus. A virus actually does replicate, but only within a cell, and it uses the machinery of the cell to replicate. So the virus plus the cell are a living system, but the virus alone is not.
So then in this context, what is death?
If we see a living system as a living network in which all these processes are interconnected, and if we see a multicellular system as consisting of cells that also form a network, then we can see that, at least in complex organisms like ourselves, as we age, some of these connections don't function so well anymore and others are completely interrupted. And the more connections are interrupted, the older the organism is. And at some stage, these interruptions are so strong that the whole system is no longer viable. So death in this systems way is really a fragmentation of components.
That would then go back to the issue of the components within the whole. We've been looking at systems theory as thinking in wholes rather than parts, but the parts do also matter.
Right. And you see, the question of death is very intriguing because one characteristic of living networks is that they not only create their own components, but they continually recycle the components. So if a molecule, does not function very well anymore, if it gets injured in some way, it's being recycled. And this recycling is a very, very intrinsic part of life. So a cell continually recycles its molecules, and a multicellular organism recycles the cells. And without this recycling, biological life would not be possible. But now think of a multicellular organism and the cells. If you shift to the level of the individual cells, this recycling process is a process of life and death, or of death and rebirth. And so death is really not the opposite of life, but it's really part of life at a higher level. And I think philosophically, that's a very intriguing insight.
How do we now connect these ideas to evolution and co-evolution?
Well, that is, to me, one of the most exciting developments in this systems view of life. that there is a new systemic understanding of evolution. And at the very core, we find the insight that evolution is not just random mutations and natural selection, which are there, of course, but we are beginning to recognize evolution as a creative unfolding of life in forms of ever-increasing diversity and complexity. And this is actually a result of complexity theory that we have discovered that living systems generally are very stable. And we all know that although, you know, we exchange our components, the system as a whole, when it's healthy, remains in a stable state. But every now and then, these stable systems encounter points of instability. And that those points of instability, the system may either break down, or what happens much more frequently, it may break through to a new regime of order. New order is created, novelty is created, emerges spontaneously at these points of instability. And that is really the core dynamics of evolution, the spontaneous emergence of novelty. And of course, genetics and all the various parts of the Darwinian theory have important roles to play. But at the very core, we find the creativity of life. Life constantly reaches out into novelty.
One of the ways that you described this in the book that I thought was very useful really emerged from the biologist Lewontin, who argued that there was, for example, no atmosphere to breathe before living organisms, suggesting that living things are co-creating the environment, and then the environment permits the organism to live.
Yes, that's right. And this is, you know, a very profound insight in biology, in systems biology, that cooperation is really fundamental. That in these living networks, you know, everything cooperates, and especially the interactions between the non-living and the living environment. That's a fascinating discovery, which is at the very heart of the so-called Gaia theory, the theory of the planet as a living system. Traditionally, the view was that we non-living or abiotic environment consisting of rocks, oceans, and atmosphere. And then life somehow happened on this non-living stage, and the living organisms then evolved as actors on this non-living stage. But the new view is that these actors actually created the stage, and it began with bacteria 3.5 billion years ago, when the first bacteria emerged from non-living matter. They immediately began to create their own environment, and they formed networks, they occupied all the niches on the planet, and they formed complex networks of regulation and communication that regulated and still regulate now the oxygen content of the atmosphere, the salinity of the oceans, and so on. So life creates its own environment in which it can flourish and evolve further.
And then the environment changes. It's just a dynamic that occurs with all the organisms, leading the organisms to change.
Yeah, as life evolves, it acts on the environment acts back. And this is not always a positive process. As we see now in our global human environment, we are polluting the atmosphere, we are sending out greenhouse gases, and the planet responds by warming, which creates all kinds of catastrophes and becomes a threat to human life on the planet.
So instead of increasing in diversity, which was the process that you described, we're instead leading to a mass extinction.
That's right.
Let's turn then to genes and genetics. You introduced Schrödinger at a point in the book about how his book led a lot of physicists to then move to genetics. How is his approach being treated by systems theory?
Well, again, the shift is from mechanics to nonlinear networks, and this very poignant example has been the Human Genome Project, which you will remember, which happened several years ago, the mapping out of the human genome, which was motivated by the desire to find certain genes on the DNA double helix, and then to say, well, here's a gene for autism, or here's a gene for Alzheimer's, and when we know where this gene is located, then we can treat the illness and develop medications and so on. But what geneticists found is that it's not enough to know the location of a gene. The genes themselves form a network, and you have to understand the dynamics of the genetic network. And moreover, the genetic network is embedded in the whole cellular network, which is also known as the epigenetic network, epi meaning beyond. So there's a network beyond genes in the cell. And it's only when you understand the complex dynamics of these networks that you really understand the function of the gene.
So, in fact, if scientists did figure out how to turn on or off a specific gene, it could potentially impact the entire network.
It could impact the entire network. And on the other hand, whether genes are turned on and off or express themselves, as biologists put it in technical language, depends largely on the environment, on the cellular environment and on the larger environment. So epigenetics is a whole field of research. And I should maybe mention here that in our book we have several guest essays by specialists in various fields. And one is about epigenetics by Patrick Bateson, who is a professor emeritus at Cambridge and a specialist in epigenetics. But let's come back to evolution. And that is, I mentioned that the inherent creativity of life is at the core of the system's view of evolution. But then there's another very important development. The classical view of evolution maintains that all evolutionary variation results from random mutations followed by natural selection. The system's view, by contrast, recognizes not only this one, but three avenues of evolution. In addition to the random mutation of genes, there's also a horizontal genetic transfer among bacteria, also known as gene trading. So bacteria spill out and absorb each other's genes at a regular basis. And that is, of course, a very, very powerful and effective way of acquiring new genes. And finally, microorganisms can ingest entire small bacteria and acquire the entire genome, much like a big corporation today would buy a telecommunications company because they need a good telecommunications system, and they will acquire the company and incorporate it. And so the acquisition of genomes and the other two mechanisms, the random mutation and the horizontal gene transfer, all of these create novelty in the genome. And there's a lot of randomness in all three of the processes. But once the new genome is created, it needs to be viable. That is, the new genes must be integrated into the old ones. And most of the time, that will not work. But sometimes it works. And when it works, that integration is a very complex process and is highly ordered. So the result here is that we're beginning to realize that randomness does play a role in evolution, but only a very minor role. Ultimately, evolution is a process that is complex, highly ordered, and is part of the whole self-organization of life.
If I were to look at it from a whole being greater than the sum of its parts, that this idea that nature is, as you said in the book, very choosy, really for the whole rather than the individual parts. It's evolving as a big picture rather than for the individuals.
everything needs to fit together. And also, we need to realize that evolution does not create structures out of nothing. It's the same patterns that are used over and over again in different combinations. It's always variations on the same basic themes. That's how evolution proceeds.
When you say the same basic themes, what's an example of a basic theme that we see?
Well, a basic theme is, you know, a basic molecule. All biochemical processes need enzymes. Enzymes are the catalysts, the facilitators of biochemistry. And there are only relatively few enzymes out of the theoretical possibility of, you know, hundreds and thousands of enzymes that are possible. There are only quite a few that nature uses. And it uses the same enzymes over and over again. The same with metabolic pathways. As I said a while ago, all structures are continually recycled. Food comes into a living organism and is processed and it's turned into structures. And this process of metabolism has certain chemical pathways which are very similar among all living organisms. So as humans, we are tightly linked to the whole living network because we share with all other organisms not only the same biomolecules, but also very much the same biochemical pathways.
As Darwin said, perhaps the same origins as well, if we go back far enough.
That, of course, is the great insight of Darwin. And in fact, we have three chapters about evolution in our book. And we begin by an homage to Darwin. At the center of Darwinian thought stands the insight that all living organisms are related by common ancestry. So literally, there is a network of relatives. We are all, as indigenous peoples often say, that all animals and plants are my relatives. In the sense of evolution, this is literally true. So all forms of life have descended from a common ancestor by a long process of modifications over billions of years. And so this is a very systemic vision that Darwin had, a vast planetary network of living beings interlinked in space and time. A very beautiful vision.
Speaking of beauty, one of the other concepts that you wrote about in this book was about symmetry and how important symmetry is in this process.
This is one of the main tools of science today, and especially of my original field of study, theoretical physics. I spent 20 years doing research in high energy physics or particle physics, and symmetry is one of the main conceptual tools. And what it means is that when you look at an object and you perform a transformation or an operation, then after the operation, the object will look exactly the same. For instance, you can take a square and you rotate it by 45 degrees and it still looks the same. And you rotate it again, it still looks the same. Or you take, you know, other forms that have symmetry axes and so on. And mathematicians use this in a very abstract way. You can have an equation describing a physical system and you apply a transformation, a mathematical transformation on the equation. And if it still looks the same afterwards, the equation is said to have a symmetry. And that's a very powerful mathematical tool.
You wrote also how this connects to art. Particularly, you wrote about Leonardo da Vinci. How does that connect?
Well, I got fascinated by Leonardo da Vinci about 15, 20 years ago. And while I was writing this textbook with my colleague Luisi, I was also studying Leonardo da Vinci's work. And I wrote two books about it. One is called The Science of Leonardo and the other one is called Learning from Leonardo. I studied Leonardo mainly as a scientist, although art and science were closely related in his work. And, you know, symmetry was an ideal of the Renaissance, and so it is noticeable in his paintings and those of other Renaissance artists.
And you wrote about the spiral.
The spiral fascinated Leonardo, and my belief is that he intuited somehow that the spiral is a basic pattern of life. And he was particularly fascinated with whirlpools, vortices in water. And what we can say from the systems point of view and from the complexity point of view about a water vortex is that the structure continually changes in terms of water particles flowing through it. The material content continually changes, and yet the basic pattern of the vortex, the characteristic funnel and spiral movement, remains the same. So there's this coexistence of stability and change. And I believe that Leonardo was fascinated by this and recognized it somehow as a symbol of life, which it is, because the coexistence of stability and change is characteristic of all living systems.
Let's move to how this all intertwines with human consciousness.
Well, this is a long and very exciting story. The systems view of life includes a new conception of mind and consciousness, which finally overcomes the Cartesian division between mind and matter. In the 17th century, Descartes made a very fundamental distinction in his view of the world into two separate and independent realms, that of mind and that of matter. And mind he called the thinking thing, the res cogitans in Latin, and matter he called the extended thing, the res extensa. And for hundreds of years after Descartes, philosophers and scientists were puzzled by this interaction between mind and matter and couldn't figure that out. How does this thinking thing interact with matter? What's the connection exactly? And the breakthrough was that we have recognized that mind and consciousness are not things but are processes, and that they are actually closely associated with the process of life, which is the process of self-generation and self-organization. So, for example, the relationship between the mind and the brain is one between process and structure. The mind, or as we say today, cognition, and there's a whole theory of cognition, the process of knowledge. Cognition is the process of knowledge closely associated with the process of life, and the brain is a particular structure through which this process takes place. But the brain is not the only structure. This theory of cognition, which is technically known or historically as the Santiago theory of cognition, this theory holds that all living systems are cognitive systems, and their bodies or their material structures embody processes that are cognitive processes. And consciousness is a particular, very complex cognitive process with the special characteristic of self-awareness. At some level of evolution, these living beings become aware of themselves. That happens in mammals fleetingly and in a transient way, and then with the great apes and humans, consciousness is a more permanent entity, and it is a process of self-awareness. In mammals and also some higher vertebrates, these are transient experiences of self, and this is what neuroscientists call primary consciousness. And then in human beings and other higher animals, there is a permanent sense of self, which then involves thinking, sense of the future and past, a sense of identity, concepts, values, and so on, and reflection. And this is what is called reflective consciousness. And here we are at the very forefront of research. We discuss in the book several new theories of consciousness, but really how this self-awareness emerges in a different dimension from neural activity is still not well understood.
You use this word proto-self related to this, and you said this is from which all thought processes, including the unconscious thought, emerge. What is this, and how does it fit into the bigger picture?
This is referring to the work of a neuroscientist called Antonio Damasio. He says that the origin of consciousness lies in certain neural structures that continually map the state of the organism. since the human organism is self-organizing, in order to organize itself efficiently, it needs to know its temperature and its biochemical balance and all these various things that you can observe and measure in a living organism. And the brain has structures that record the state of the organism from minute to minute. And this recording of the state of the organism and its interaction with the environment is what Damasio calls proto-self. It's not conscious. This is at the level of neurophysiological processes. And then somehow, in a way which is not quite understood, this proto-self generates the awareness of being a self. And that's when consciousness emerges.
Well, you end the book with a lot of exploration about social problems, environmental problems. How can we now fit all this together?
To me, this is very important. There are 200 pages in the book. The whole last part is called Sustaining the Web of Life, where we discuss many, many practical applications of the systems view of life. And basically, what we say is that the skill of thinking systemically in terms of networks and patterns is very critical today, because the world's problems are all interconnected. Whether we talk about energy, or we talk about climate change, or we talk about social inequality, or whatever problem we are discussing, we see that they cannot be treated in isolation. They are systemic problems, which means that they are interconnected and interdependent. And so we need this kind of systemic thinking to understand them and solve them.
The book, again, is called The Systems View of Life, A Unifying Vision. Thank you again for being with us on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Fritjof Capra is a theoretical physicist who has authored The Tao of Physics, The Turning Point, The Hidden Connections, and his latest, The Systems View of Life. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.